Good afternoon, and welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We've tried to encourage critical thinking and science as a way to appreciate what we really know about the physical world, but perhaps this isn't always enough. Research findings are prone to distortion by a surprising number of sources and for a variety of reasons. Our phone numbers in Anchorage are 550-8422, our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, our email address, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at APRN.org. Coming up this hour, our topic is distortion of health information on Line 1, your health connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's topic is the distortion of healthcare information. As I mentioned earlier, our phone numbers should be familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska in Anchorage. It's 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And our email address, line1@APRN.org. My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. He's a senior epidemiologist in the Department of Epidemiology and Population Health at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and he's the author of Hyping Health Risks, Environmental Hazards in Daily Life, and The Science of Epidemiology, which examines what we know about some high-profile health concerns and how this information gets manipulated. I'm going to introduce Dr. Cabot in just a second, but before we get started, let me mention that next week's program will be comparing healthcare systems with ours, with those of other nations, to examine the myths and to look for help in, as we reform our system. My guest will be Dr. Stephen Miles of the University of Minnesota School of Medicine. Dr. Cabot, it's a pleasure to have you on Line One.
Same here. Thank you.
The first place to start is just kind of getting into why you wrote the book Hyping Health Risks.
Well, as an epidemiologist who does research on mainly on the causes of cancer, from smoking to heavy alcohol consumption to hormone use and so on, electromagnetic fields are some of the things, in the early 90s, I just observed what was being made of certain topics in the media, and some of the topics that one was hearing about were DDT and PCDs and their possible role in breast cancer. Passive smoking was another one. Radon was a third, and electromagnetic fields. And I just, as someone who was doing work on some of those topics and who knew the literature, who knew the scientific literature and how the studies were done and what they showed, I felt that, wait a minute, there's some real distortion going on. So I began to do two things. I both continued to work as an epidemiologist on these questions, but I also began to look at how these things were represented in the media and in the wider society, almost as if I were, say, an anthropologist or something. Just because I found these distortions, these exaggerations, I found them fascinating. But I was also concerned because I feel, and we come back to this, but I felt that people were being misled. Their attention was being diverted by things.
I certainly want to get into those specific things, discoveries that you made, and how you've written about it so nicely. But perhaps a better way to really get into this would be to paint us a picture and use an example from your book of what you're talking about, what you found.
Okay. I'm going to take an example I'm going to take the example of passive smoking. Although it's, I'm not totally comfortable using it because it's tobacco, and we all know that smoking is bad for you. And I wouldn't want people to get the wrong idea, but you'll see why this is such a good example. There have been good studies done really in the mid-90s that show that the average person who's exposed, who's not a smoker herself or himself, but is exposed to a smoking, a spouse in the home who smokes, which is the main source of exposure, receives about 1/1000th of the exposure of the average smoker. And the average smoker consumes, say, a pack a day of cigarettes. So the exposure is 1/1000th. Now, and people have done calculations, and comes out to a couple of cigarettes, maybe comes out to eight cigarettes per year of exposure if someone smokes in your home and you're exposed to the smoke. Now, I wouldn't say that's nothing, but it's certainly not smoking a pack of cigarettes or two packs of cigarettes day in, day out, which we know quite firmly causes lung cancer and other diseases, and that's very well established. When you get down to exposures that are 1/1000th of what active smoking is, we're on shaky ground, and those studies of passive smoking, I felt, and I've done some of them, and that's how I was clued in to those problems. Those kinds of studies have problems because the exposure is so low, and it is so that people can't tell you how much smoke they're exposed to, and you can't measure anything in their bodily fluids to see how much they've been exposed to over the past 20 years or so. So people got passive smoking was pushed for reasons which we could go into, but it was pushed not really for scientific reasons. It was pushed for other reasons, and essentially because it was a when it was first arose in the late 70s and early 80s, people realized that hey, if smoking is not only affecting the smoker himself, but is also harming the bystander, wow, then this really becomes. This becomes a very powerful weapon to fight tobacco use with.
Yeah, so it can push the political agenda tremendously.
Right. Well, the political agenda really coincided with the health agenda.
All right, okay.
But the only casualty was that you had to sort of ignore the weakness of the scientific studies.
Yeah.
So it was really, and people did not like it when you pointed this out.
Right. Right. So what started you on this quest was this skepticism. As you looked at the information, you said, "Gosh, is it really true that this somewhat harder to define exposure, and we don't know what the dose effect is? We don't know how to tell. Is it really significant or not?" And that's where, and that led you to look at it a little bit deeper. And then, as a consequence, you're not so sold that the evidence suggests that that's a significant health risk.
Well, let me say that I think there's no reason why people should be forced to be exposed to smoke. I'm very clear on that, and have strong feelings about that. And there are good reasons, aesthetic reasons, and also acute effects like exacerbation of asthma or allergies.
Absolutely.
And so forth. So there are good reasons, but we're not, the evidence that it causes fatal diseases like lung cancer and heart disease has been inflated.
Ah, yeah. All right. Fair, and that's very specific, and that's also what good thinkers do is they define their terms, and they're very, very specific about what they're trying to say, and I appreciate that. So a lot of what we're talking about today, just to kind of put some ground rules down or some understanding, is epidemiology. So could you just explain succinctly to our listeners a little bit about what epidemiology is all about, what it can do, and for sure what it can't do?
Okay. Well, epidemiology is the study of the distribution and of the occurrence of various diseases, as well as the distribution of factors that are connected, associated with the disease that you're studying, with a view to controlling the disease or establishing the cause of the disease, and ultimately controlling it and reducing it or eradicating it. And a good example, classic example, is cigarette smoking. And lung cancer was a rare disease at the turn of the last century, and after World War One, troops were issued free cigarettes, and smoking cigarettes took hold in the 20s and 30s, and you see lung cancer in men first rose to epidemic proportions in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and then as women took up smoking 20 or 30 years later, because women became a mark of independence in the 60s, the lung cancer rose, became epidemic in women. So and all studies where you conducted studies where you looked at people who got lung cancer and people without lung cancer, and you compared their smoking habits, you saw a very strong difference indicating that there was that cigarette smoking was strongly associated with whether or not someone got lung cancer. So that's what the kind of thing one's talking about in epidemiology.
So you really are kind of looking at a population and seeing what their exposure risks are and what percentage of people, so to speak, not to make it too simple, that are exposed and have a problem, and those that are exposed and don't have a problem, and you get some relative risks ratios.
Right.
Is that the kind of thing that happens?
Right. It's how does the whether or not they have the exposure. In the most simple case, are they a smoker or are they not a smoker? So that's the simple case. And did they get the disease or didn't they get the disease? And if there's a positive association, if people who have the exposure, say they're smokers, are much, much more likely to get lung cancer, then you have a nice, strong relationship with which, if certain other things hold up, if smoking precedes getting lung cancer, you can have other association isn't always equal to causation, but if certain other things hold true, then you have a candidate for a really important cause of a disease. And so there have been studies of many, many other things, diet, hormones, and so on, and they're as causes of various diseases.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. You can call us at 550-8422 if you're local. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255, and our email is line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at APRN.org about any questions or comments about what you're hearing today. Another, I think, important point, which gets down to definitions again, is often we see X is associated with Y. Drinking milk is associated with milk allergy. What's the difference between association and causal effects, and where does epidemiology fall into these definitions?
Okay. And finding an association between an exposure and a disease is just finding a correlation. There are many, many more associations than there are causes identified. So people came up with criteria for judging whether an association was causal, and some of the points that have to be met are: is there a strong relationship? Because if it's too tenuous and too weak or too inconsistent, then maybe it's due to confounding, which means basically that maybe it's really due to something else that's correlated with the exposure you're looking at. So there's always that. I mentioned that the exposure needs to precede the disease, which seems it seems obvious, but in fact, it needs to be precede the disease by long enough, and so that in the case of smoking is something that people take up on average when they're around 15. On average, if they don't quit, they do it for 40 or 45 years. And again, on average, those who will get lung cancer on average of age 62. So there, you have a very strong temporal case, the time relationship. Another component of the explanation is that we know that when people stop smoking, so when you take away the exposure, a person's risk of lung cancer and risk of heart disease goes down quite steeply. And so those are some of the... Another thing is it helps if you have evidence from animal experiments, because we can't experiment on human beings, but we can paint tobacco smoke chemicals on the backs of mice, and lo and behold, in these kinds of experiments, they developed certain kinds of cancers. Mm-hmm. So all of that, when you get those kinds of independent findings, when you have them all pointing to something, then you have a pretty strong case.
Yeah, and I think another one that is really important, and maybe you mentioned it, and I was looking around at my screen here a little bit, is a good medical explanation. There has to be some reason to think that association makes some sense.
Right.
Based on our current knowledge of how things work, for example.
Right. But of course, that's true, and people always say that, but then again, often we learn new things, and
sure,
there may be relationships that are not that's always a possibility that we don't understand how it could happen. It doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't a causal relationship, but if we had a mechanism, it certainly would help.
Right. Right. There was, I guess, an example, I think it was similar, people have been very concerned about vaccines causing autism or something related to them, and some author made a point that why would we necessarily blame vaccines, because autism seemed to be increasing, which is another issue, whether it's true or not. At about the same time, cell phones are, you know, text messaging came in. Lots of other things are happening coincidental,
mm-hmm,
that it may,
mm-hmm,
appear to be associated and make a lot of sense, but then you can't explain how that might happen very well.
That's right. And so there are many correlations, but causation is a much higher order of things.
Another very important medical issue that's come up recently that I suspect has a lot of political kinds of agenda, or some, you could use your explanations of what you've discovered when looking at some of this medical science, is this business about the new mammography recommendations from the Public Health Service. These are a group of individuals, 12 of them, I think 6 of them are women. They use information from research centers around the country. It's really fairly unbiased, it looks like to me. And then the recommendations changed for most women for getting screening mammography from 40 to 50. Again, it's not for individuals, but as a group of people. And boy, that had caused a storm. What are your comments? What can we learn from this?
Okay, I think it's a very interesting example, and I do think that the Preventive Services Task Force that they are really just trying to formulate guidelines based on the best available data. And actually, these recommendations are not... we've known for a long time that mammographic screening is not as effective in women in their 40s as it is in women 50 and over. And there are two reasons for that. One is that breast cancer is less common in women in their 40s, and much less common. And secondly, women before menopause have denser breasts, and the denser breasts make it harder to detect what you're looking for in a mammogram. So there are two very good reasons, and it's been this has been known for a very long time. But the problem is this, that as Dr. Woodard said, these guidelines apply to groups, and not everyone is the same in just because they fall in a group. And there are certainly women in their 40s and their early 40s who have had lumps discovered that turned out to be cancer that were removed and treated, and they feel that that their life was saved due to having a mammogram in their 40s, in their early 40s. So I would stress that these are individual decisions that each woman needs to make in concert with her physician. And but nevertheless, these things, one shouldn't shoot the messenger just because
right.
the data do indicate that screening is not as effective. And there are different considerations. And when one looks, mammograms cost a certain amount of money. If you advocated screening for everybody, that has a cost. There's another cost. And that cost is that few of these screening tests are perfect, and many of them are far from perfect, and they turn up things. They turn up things, and those things that they turn up lead to biopsies, and many of them will never develop into anything, and yet people may they'll have invasive procedures done, biopsies, surgery for some of them, just to be sure, and there can be harm done from these interventions based on screening. So there are what we call false positives, and that's part of the downside. So that's what when one looks at the whole story, one has to take. It's not only how many cancers are found, and they're going to be a very small number overall in women if all women under 40 were under 50 were screened, but it's also the negative effects.
I think it was you that pointed out, we were emailing back and forth a New York Times report by probably an epidemiologist, I can't remember, that said even if you had a positive a positive biopsy, or at least if you had a biopsy and it was said to be true, I mean, the odds were still only 1 in 3 that this was truly a cancer. In people less than 50. So it kind of puts in perspective is that there
right.
this is not a perfect screening test. It's one of the things. And they never said that this is for everybody. For example, maybe black women who have a higher incidence, it may be a whole different calculation that goes on. So it really
right.
got thrown out of perspective. And that brings me to what about the politics? One of our senators, Lisa Murkowski, and a group of bipartisan congressmen attempted to initiate an investigation on how this guideline was developed. It seems like that may fit into the thesis of your book somewhat. Do you think so?
Yeah, I think that one of my strong feelings is that the science is difficult enough, and once you throw in politics, it just makes things all the, you know, you might as well throw up your hands. And I think there are reasons why the people want to scientists politicians want to pronounce on these things, but this is an example of politics of meddling in something where this was a really carefully done assessment by a very qualified group, and the politician should know better than to use it to it really is a matter for scientists, health officials, and agencies like the National Cancer Institute to make recommendations based on that.
Okay. We're going to have to take a small short break. I want to get back and really address the specific reasons why healthcare or why any research gets kind of distorted in just a second. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. In Anchorage, call 550-8422, our toll-free number 1-800-478-8255, or you can email us at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue with Dr. Jeffrey Cabot on Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, your health connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center, providing Alaska women complete breast imaging services since 1986, including radiologists who specialize in breast imaging 5 days a week. Information online at provimaging.com. And by the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Attention hunters, you must apply now for all drawing hunts and for all Tier 1 and Tier 2 hunts in 2010 and in 2011. There is no application period in the spring of 2010. Be sure to tell hunters they can apply online until December 31st. Information online at wildlife.alaska.gov or 1-907-267-2257. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
This is Line 1, your health connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's guest is Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. He's the author of Hyping Health Risks, Environmental Hazards in Daily Life, and the Science of Epidemiology. If you have questions or comments, email us at line1@aprn.org. Call us directly at 550-8422. Or if you're outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-800-478-8255. And please remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 on Monday night, that's a recorded program, and we won't be here to answer your questions. You've done a great job, Dr. Cabot, of describing some specific examples of what has happened with healthcare research and how it gets distorted. But let's talk now a little bit, if you don't mind, about what are all the factors? How does this happen? Who's causing this to happen? What's the psychology, so to speak, of what's happening to change the information or interpret the information to somebody's benefit?
Well, I think we've all been schooled in a way to be very acutely aware of any threat to our health, and I think that's and also environmental hazards. So I think this has really developed in the past 30 or so years with discoveries. Like the discovery that something you can do, something that seemed like a harmless habit, smoking, that it can actually have a major impact on your health and your life. So as we see all of these reports in the media, I think what they do is they underscore that there are all these things out there, all these different possible hazards, and they can have all these different impacts on some area of our health. So that's one thing. And one has the growth of research in this area. So people are cranking out studies on this, that, and the other thing, and does it affect health? How does it affect health? And these things get reported. And by the way, scientists have to publish their work. And by the way, if you find nothing, if suppose you do an analysis of factor X in relation to factor Y, and it's a disease Y, and you come up with nothing, well, it's very hard to get that published. So what often happens is there's always something interesting going on in, you know, some corner of your data. So, and no less personage than an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine pointed out that there's this tendency for people to take some finding and sort of say, well, maybe this is important, and to stress that in order to get the paper published. So that this is actually a key ingredient in what goes on. And if you find something, you have to argue for, well, is this important or isn't it important? So this is, it really, I don't see how one can get rid of this. It's inherent in science. And then government agencies, and this happened with passive smoking, it happened with radon, it happened with electromagnetic fields. Government agencies feel, oh, well, the public is concerned about this, and we want to respond, and we want to make recommendations telling them to avoid exposure to this, that, and the other thing. And there's a tendency certainly in the media, where you're getting one study. One study tells you nothing. You need a lot of different studies, preferably well done, large enough populations, and replicated, repeated in different situations before you can establish credibly that something is really a hazard. And yet, what you hear on the news is just one study and should be treated skeptically. But as studies mount up, accrue, and as different groups say, this cell phone business or this electromagnetic fields business, this seems like something that the public needs to be aware of and protected against, they can go off and they won't even necessarily know the details of the studies. So they can go, they have a mission and they draft a report. And the report says that we know that such and such is a health hazard or is a probable health hazard, which is almost the same thing. And then, so then if you go back, and this is what I did in some of my cases, if you go back and you look, well, what is the evidence that it's based on? The evidence may turn out to be very weak, very inconsistent, and very contradictory. And because we're susceptible to making these things, manufacturing these things into something more important than they are in many cases. Now, of course, there are examples of things that we do need to pay attention to, and which are, and we can get into that, and which are we know enough about to know that we should avoid them.
We've got a couple of email messages and a phone call, and I think the first one is extremely important to get into the, I don't know what the right term, the nuances and the very specifics of the secondhand smoke issue, Dr. Cabot. This comes from a listener who is with the American Cancer Society, and I'm going to read her email. It says, I am concerned the comments made earlier seem to minimize the risk of exposure to secondhand smoke. These comments are in conflict with the 2006 U.S. Surgeon General's report, which stated that there are no safe exposure levels to secondhand smoke. In releasing the report, the Surgeon General Carmona stated, quote, the debate is over, the science is clear, secondhand smoke kills, end quote. I hope you'll clarify this issue for your listeners.
Okay.
This kind of puts it in a nutshell almost.
Okay. I know the people who drafted that report. I was on an EPA committee with the first major U.S. report 1992 on passive smoking and lung cancer and other respiratory diseases. And I can tell you that these things are first and foremost not about science. They are first and foremost political documents. And there aren't too many people who could cite chapter and verse on the studies that have been done. There are now 70, 80 studies, but I've read the core studies that were done up through the 90s, and I've contributed to that literature. And I can tell you that the effect is very, very small, and at that level, epidemiology breaks down. We can't resolve things at that level, and that's why I said earlier that the exposure on average is about a thousandth that of what the active smoker is getting. And that's exactly what you see in the epidemiology. You see you see relative risks hovering around 1.0. Some of them are above 1.0, some of them are below 1.0. 1.0 would be, there's no association, but 1.25 or something, it would be, there's a slight increase, okay? Now, what happens is that the positive studies get a lot of mileage and get a lot of reporting, and the negative studies get ignored because they've got to be wrong because they didn't find anything. Well, that's where it breaks down, and it's simply in my reading, and I go into the story in great depth in the book. It's not first and foremost about the science.
Let me also hopefully not muddy the waters, but make this point a little bit more succinct. I'm looking at your book on page 34 and 35, where you have two tables, and this is looking at relative risk of certain problems associated with different exposures. And for lung cancer in males, a never smoker has a risk of 1.0. That's the reference level. If you were a former smoker, it's 3.5, and for a current smoker, it's 11.9. And then you go over and you look at a spouse who's never, and now we're looking at spouses, lung cancer, their lifetime risk in non-smokers. A spouse who's never smoked, again, would be 1.0, and a spouse who smoked 1.24. So there's a tremendous variable. I mean, so if you say secondhand smoke kills, you're always going to be almost right, but the issue is, what's the relative risk? It's like, another thing that bothers me is it's similar to, yeah, it's true that mothers who are pregnant should never have any alcohol, but I mean, there, you know, so it is true that maybe a little bit at the wrong period during pregnancy may have an effect, but you know, that risk is pretty low, and we really don't know enough about that particular risk. Anyway, the point being that when you say secondhand smoke kills, yes, it is, but what's the real risk? And maybe that's not even true because of the levels of relative risk are very small, which is what you said.
And even that 1.24, that's from one report, and that does not represent the total disclosure of the totality of the best studies on that question. It would come out to around 1.1. Okay,
all right.
So a 10% increase is just something that's it's very hard to say what that means, if anything. And one has to acknowledge that, I think.
Yeah. And again, nobody, you know, nobody's saying that smoking is good in any way, shape, or form and that it doesn't cause problems. It's just when you really look at the science, is what you're saying, the science for secondhand smoke causing lung cancer and heart disease is not.
It's pretty
that,
weak. It's pretty weak, and we
okay.
know that.
Okay. Right. All right. We have a phone call I want to take right now. Bill, you're on line one.
Yeah, well, I think that's the point the Cancer Society was trying to make, though, is that, you know, this is pretty much common sense, that you don't need a scientist to prove that secondhand smoke affects anybody. Just watch a baby in a room when a parent lights up a cigarette. I mean, you just see an immediate reaction from the kid. He starts wheezing and coughing. And
Not all babies cough and wheeze. You know, so, yeah, it doesn't always happen like that.
you know, I went to graduate school and got an MPH, so I could talk to you docs, because what you've done here is you've flooded the world with a whole bunch of data. But the bottom line here is that smoking kills, and it kills deadly. My dad passed away 8 years ago from smoking, and, you know, I don't know, I didn't read your book, but the point here is that smoking kills. Tobacco kills. There's guys going around saying chewing tobacco is great. You know, I mean, it's not. Tobacco kills, and that's
now hold it. But the whole thing is to make distinctions and to put things in perspective. That's what I'm talking about.
How much of your audience even understands relative risk? I bet about 10% of the audience even knows what that means.
You have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
And let me pick up on what you said about chewing tobacco, or I would say smokeless tobacco. And one has to make distinctions. And you brought up something that I think is important, because smoking kills. It's responsible for maybe a third of cancer, okay? So there's no debate about that, and contributes to other diseases. But we tend to, by blowing up things that are demonstrably much lower level of importance, we can confuse people. And the smokeless tobacco issue is a really important example for the following reason. There's the type of smokeless tobacco that's used in Sweden. Sweden has, I believe, the lowest rate of smoking in the United States, and their rates of lung cancer and tobacco-related diseases have gone way down since people have switched to, it's called snus, snuff.
Right. Yeah,
because people are very absolutist, like there's no form of tobacco that isn't harmful, they fail to appreciate what the data show. And what the data show is that you can reduce the risk of by switching from active smoking to smokeless tobacco, you can reduce the risk of these cancers, tobacco-related cancers, by 90 or maybe 95% or something. So this is an example, I think, of distinctions that are really important to make.
Well, yeah, of course you don't inhale smokeless tobacco, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's you don't get lung cancer from chew,
if people could make the switch, giving people an alternative and really saving a lot of lives.
As a healthcare professional, could you recommend to your patient to switch over to... I think that would be unconscionable. I think the best thing is just tell them to quit. Get quit.
There are people who can quit, and then there are people who are very hardcore addicted smokers. Yeah. And I'm not a clinician, I think that to not recommend something like that is objectionable.
Up here in Alaska, our Alaska Native population, I mean, 40-50% of little tiny 3-year-old babies are walking around chewing tobacco.
That's terrible, and I'm not encouraging.
No, yeah. It's unreal, you know. No. And I'm not just talking out of my head here.
We're getting off the subject, Bill. I appreciate your comments. And
one last comment.
All right.
There's politics in a monkey herd, so we have to learn to play the politics. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it. Dr. Cabot, another email came in, and I think it's worth addressing. And you mentioned it earlier. I'm not picking on you, but I think I want to bring everything out. You talked about shooting the messenger, and so the Lung Association, the Heart Association, the Cancer Association, all have looked at this data and all have quick and rapid responses. And I got an email of the response to your study and Dr. Enstrom's study on secondhand smoke from the, which was evaluated from the American Non-Smokers' Rights Foundation, concerning the studies that you had done and Dr. Enstrom that may have had some problems with it. And there's, first off, I'd have to say there's no perfect research, but you're one of the, when you're like you are and you're out there saying, let's be critical, let's not over-dramatize, let's really look at the facts. If they don't lead you where you want you to go, don't just jump to the conclusion that it's wrong. If that's what I hear you saying, I want to give you some chance to respond to people saying, well, wait a minute, your research isn't so good, or you may have alternative motives as well.
Okay.
Comments. What are your comments about the reviews?
But I haven't heard any criticism yet.
Well, it was
I know what they're referring to, but it's hard to defend this study. Let me talk about the 2003 study published in the British Medical Journal, BMJ.
All right.
It's the largest study with the most detailed information ever undertaken on passive smoking, exposure to a smoking spouse, and heart disease. It's not the largest study dealing with lung cancer, but it has the most deaths from heart disease, and it followed a group of California never smokers in the American Cancer Society study from 1959 to 1998 for 38 years, and it's far from a perfect study, but let me tell you, it's a lot better than a lot of the studies that found an effect, okay? And we didn't, we had an obligation to publish the results. You have to judge how good the study is, not whether you like the result or not. And that study caused an enormous furor, mainly among anti-smoking groups. But that's the problem, that you can't make policy based on one or two studies. And there are good reasons for people to have regulations either limiting exposure through filtration and so on and so forth, or through smoking bans. And I don't have feelings. People should be protected against exposure to smoke, but you shouldn't have to overstate what the science shows
I think one of the most powerful...
That's where we get into trouble.
Yeah. I think one of the most powerful things about science is it if it's done well, it's just constantly taking you where the evidence is, not what your feelings are. And it's difficult for humans to give up thoughts. I mean, and to keep an open mind about it. I get a little bit out of shape when people attack you for something like, I like this bit of critical thinking about what the information is and really looking at it.
But other studies, if you go back and you line up our data with other studies by the American Cancer Society, they show the same thing. And I do that in my book in that chapter on passive smoking.
Well, there could be another issue, just to move on, what's the harm? And when I think about what's the harm, the first thing that comes to me is the silicone breast implant issue that basically destroyed a company. And really, when it got down to it, there was nothing there. You want to talk about that one? And that's not talked about in your book, but I think it's a good example.
It is a good example. And here, really, there were anecdotal reports, so not systematic scientific studies. There were anecdotal reports of women who had had silicone breast implants and then developed connective tissue disorders or immune system disorders. And that led to class action suits against Dow Corning, the manufacturer of I guess the most popular type of silicone breast implant, and the FDA got involved, and the FDA put a hold, I believe, on the manufacture of silicone breast implants. But there weren't really good studies of this. When studies, so Dow Corning went bankrupt, And as a result of these class action suits, and people were convinced that there was something there, when careful studies were done of both of connective tissue disorders and of breast cancer, which was another fear, they really showed zip. They really showed nothing. Now, but this raises an important point, and that is that you, and maybe this will put me in the better graces with some of the people who have raised some questions. You can never be sure that you've excluded some small effect. That's sort of the flip side of what we're talking about with detecting an effect of passive smoking. So I wouldn't want to say that, and no researcher would ever say, you'd have to have a study with millions and millions of women to be able to say that there's absolutely no effect. But for practical purposes, there have been large studies that really showed that there does not seem to be much of any detectable effect from these things. So all of the scares seem to have been not well founded.
We've got about 7 minutes. In the next 7 minutes, what I'd like to do is comment on one more non-medical issue that's really prone to distortion, again, to show how good science can get very difficult, especially when it gets down to the public, and then ask you about how do we go about sorting through all this. So what's the issue? Climate change. It seems to me, if you ask anybody, there's lots of opinions, but it's a perfect example where there's a lot of good science but a lot of distortion, and people are very confused.
Well, first of all, I'm not a climate scientist, although I'm interested in the debate, and I do know some people who follow this, and so my thoughts come from discussions with these people. Uh-huh. And I think it's a good example in that it's terribly complicated, as the causation of something like breast cancer or Alzheimer's disease is complicated. Climate is even more complicated. And the people who are on one side or the other side feel that they have to, the people who feel that climate change is putting us on a course to disaster feel that they have to wake people up, and they can't wake people up by being wishy-washy or saying, well, you know, there are all sorts of things that we don't understand. And so that's one side of the debate. The people who deny that climate change is something to really worry about or do anything about pick up on the inconsistencies and that we've had a cold winter or something like that, or the many pieces that don't fit. So I think one has to say, there are exaggerations and distortions on both sides, but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the UN, with 1,000 scientists around the world participating, has, I'm told, done as good a job as one could expect of distilling the science. Mm-hmm. But there's one thing that happens, and that is, people don't read the huge opus, that report that came out in 2007. What they read is the political summary, and that's where the problem comes in, because in order to convince people, you need to emphasize certain things, and maybe you emphasize some of the more dire predictions and things, which have maybe more uncertainty associated with them. So that's the kind of, and then people, of course, pick holes, or they discover the emails from the UK, and they find out that hey, scientists are human. You know, as those of you who have read about the treasure trove of emails. But I don't think any of that changes the basic fact that there is something going on. There are unanswered questions, but it does look as if the buildup of greenhouse gases due to, in part, to human activity, that it is having an effect, and we need to, you know, progress to determine in an unemotional way what should be done about that. And those are scientific questions, and even there we're not going to have the answers. But it only if people don't penetrate to what are the basic facts, then we'll just be, you know, having shouting matches over it.
The last couple of minutes, what can we do? What can all of us do to look more critically at health information? Are there sources of information we can go to? What are the hints? What's the bottom line here? What do we need to be doing better?
Well, first of all, I think I mentioned that we have to be skeptical about individual reports that we read in the media, because they're just selected, and what's important in science is the overall, the totality of the evidence. And good sources of information, I think, are in general places like the National Institutes of Health and the National Cancer Institute. They have good information. The American Cancer Society generally, I believe, has very sound information. There's a group in New York called the American Council on Science and Health, which takes as its mission to correct some of these scares that appear in the media. And they, day in, day out, they have something called their morning update, and in a straightforward, easily understandable way, they tell you why some of these things that get a lot of press are not what they're cracked up to be. So there are I think, sources of critical information, and I think one has to pay attention to the big things and the important things and the things that we can control, and not get distracted by these little blips that are likely to be not important.
Well, I really want to say thanks very much for taking the time and for writing the book. I think it gives us a cause to stop and think and be critical. So thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Line 1 is going to return next week, as we said before, with Dr. Stephen Miles of the University of Minnesota School of Medicine. With his help, we'll compare the healthcare system of our own country with those of other industrialized nations and examine the myths and look for help as we reform our system. Pat Yak is president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.